Good afternoon and welcome back to Cresta the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter here, filling in for Al Cresta. We just had a truly enlightening conversation with Peter Herbeck, and as insightful as that was, I want to greatly encourage you to look at the program that will be taking place at 7 p.m. at Christ the King in Ann Arbor next Tuesday. In the remaining two segments, we're going to be talking to Jeremy Duo about penance as devotion and as an act of Christian virtue. When we face challenges in life, it's a common practice to offer it up to God. In fact, most of us who are brought up Catholic are constantly told that. But does this imply that God likes to see us suffer, which is one of the many misconceptions about the Christian faith, and particularly the Catholic expression of the Christian faith? Jeremy Duo was born and raised in Gibraltar, where he co-founded the Saxum Institute, a catechetical institute. He holds bachelor's and master's degrees from Franciscan University of Steubenville. He lives with his family in Fort Worth, Texas, where he is the headmaster of Chesterton Academy of Fort Worth and hosts the Practicing Catholics podcast. Visit chestertonacademyfw.org. Jeremy, how are you doing?
Doing very well, Marcus. Thanks for having me.
No, the honor is all ours. So, Jeremy, I really want to ask you, you penned this article, and I think it's truly beautiful, and it's borrowing from a lot of very classical as well as theological principles, but what prompted you to want to look at penance as devotion?
Well, one of the things that really prompted me to look at that was the time of publication, actually. When they told me that they wanted to publish around April, I thought, well, that's going to be around Easter time. And one of the things that quickly goes out the window during Easter time is penance, right? We've just come off the back.
That's right. I've done this for 44 days and I'm done with this.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. So everything goes out the window, but we forget that even though Lent is over, we still live in the Valley of Tears, so to speak. And it's not just a matter of penance is not just a matter of punishing ourselves, but of showing God a certain devotion that we have within Him, right? Something that I would rather, like I said in the article, I would rather have this discomfort and have you, God, than not have the discomfort but not have you. Something like that, right? So there's an interior act of love that needs to undergird penance always, right?
That's right. And perhaps let's address exactly that misconception right off the bat, which is this terrible misrepresentation of God and the image of God as this sadistic dictator who can't wait to impose extra sufferings upon the backs of the people who profess faith in Him to punish them for all the wrong that they've done. When in fact, this stands in stark juxtaposition to the revelation of God first as covenantal God and then through the person of Jesus Christ, intimate covenantal Father.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, it reminds me of the juxtaposition between Pharaoh and God in the book of Exodus, right? So Pharaoh seems to get a kick out of all the sufferings of the Israelites. But God says the opposite. I have heard the cries of my people, right?
Right.
And so, yeah, He's not bloodthirsty. He's not a dictator, as you say.
So then, now you penned this article, so you do a good job of articulating this. So let's really begin this discussion, which is, if God doesn't enjoy watching me suffer, why does He allow so much suffering to befall me?
Sure. Well, so the occasion of suffering is an opportunity for us to show love, to show virtue, right? I think, and this happens on the horizontal plane between friends, between family members, acquaintances even, where we get to see the genuineness of an action or the love with which an action is conducted, right? So, for example, if I help you out with something which also helps me out, then, you know, it can always be subject to suspicion. It's like, well, you're only doing that because it helps you, right?
Right.
But when we see someone do something for us that really only gives them suffering or discomfort or difficulty, then we're a lot more willing and a lot more quick to be moved by the action and say, wow, that person did that for me, and it was totally selfless, right? And so it's no different with God, right? The opportunity to suffer shows God, not because he doesn't know, because of course he knows all things even before we ask him or before we do them, but shows God and it even shows ourselves, right, that we are doing it only because we love him, mm-hmm. right? Not because there's going to be some sort of benefit or reward for me, right?
Right, right. And then you go on to talk about the sacramentality of not just pain and suffering, but even our conduct in how we handle pain and suffering. So just explicate that entire notion.
Yeah, so well, the whole Catholic faith, this is really important for anyone to really understand when doing any kind of theology, the whole Catholic faith is sacramental. And what I mean by that is that, so a sacrament in a basic definition, not just one of the seven sacraments, but any kind of sacrament with a lowercase s, is just a visible sign of something invisible, right? So
right.
You could say like a flag is the sacrament of a nation, or a logo is a sacrament of an organization, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you can go deeper and say, my body is a sacrament of my soul, right? So in the same way, we can talk about the action that I perform should be a sacrament of my intention.
Right.
Right?
Now, just for the benefit of our listeners, I just want to make very clear here, like Jeremy just said, this is not in refutation or even addition to the seven sacraments. In fact, this right. etymologically simply means sacramentum. It's a sign that points to something that's greater than itself.
Yes, yes. Yeah, the uniqueness of the seven sacraments is the fact that the thing signified and the sign are one and the same thing.
That's right.
So Jesus, for example, who is a sacrament of God, he is a sacrament, he is a sign of God, he is God, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he is what he signifies. So that's why the seven sacraments act like that, is because they flow from Christ, who is what he signifies. So those seven are privileged sacraments, if you will. But yeah, like you said, sacramentum in Latin meaning sign, it's just something that signifies something invisible, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, and again, going back to the also important part is that our actions ought to be sacraments, ought to be just outward signs of our invisible intentions,
right?
Right. So, if I do something for you that looks perhaps difficult or has caused me discomfort in some way or even pain, but it's brought some benefit to you, then hopefully that is a sacrament of the love that I have for you, right? And and it would be through that sacrament that love is more visible to you, right? Because it's manifested through the outward sign.
Right, right, exactly. And anyone who's striving for virtue and striving for, in fact, you go through the works of this to demonstrate that at its core, the embracing of penance compels us to a life of true selflessness, that undergoing suffering virtuously really does beget in us a true expression of love. Anyone who's in love, anyone who truly loves someone, understands that the highest expression of that love is to will the good of the other over myself, over my own personal, temporal, mediocre goods.
Yes, yes. I'm reminded of Mother Teresa, Saint Teresa of Calcutta, in fact. She said, love isn't love until it hurts.
Mm-hmm. Right. So we've talked about that in kind of a grander picture, right? But at the same time, the Church does not tell us to pretend as if pain and suffering are to be ignored. If anything, the Church acknowledges pain is painful, suffering is excruciating, and pain, to borrow from C.S. Lewis in The Problem of Pain, pain cries to be heard. It demands to be felt. And so the Church acknowledges this and provides this kind of a balm through the occurrence of pain and suffering.
That's right. That's right. Absolutely. You're totally right. Yeah, sure. Yeah, go ahead. I mean, that's great.
I was borrowing from, I'm really borrowing from what you've written, right? So at the same time, there's also this compulsion to, or at least at the very least, an exhortation from the Church for us to learn to experience happiness in God, in and through the pain that we're experiencing. You call it a change of tune. So, you know, talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, so there's something interesting when that happens when we suffer, right? Whether it's voluntary or involuntary, where things are put into perspective, right? Mm. And when that perspective is kind of adjusted or corrected, we see the things that truly matter, and that what falls away is what happens through the purification of suffering, right? So when we suffer, we're being purified, and what falls away, what is purified, are those kind of baser ways of looking at the world or our own situations. And so when we see things through the light of suffering, and when we see the goodness that suffering can bring, doesn't necessarily always bring it, because it depends on how we deal with it. But when we see the goodness that suffering can bring, that is when we experience, like you said, that change of tune, when we see what people call the silver lining, right?
Right.
So when we look at the cross, we see, well, this doesn't make a lot of sense, but only through the cross do we get to the resurrection, and then everything makes sense.
Right.
And we see things through the lens of not just the resurrection, but also the cross now. The cross actually makes sense because of the resurrection, but before that, it doesn't. But that's why faith is so important. Because we're always looking at this dynamic of cross and resurrection, right? In the moment, sometimes suffering doesn't make a lot of sense.
That's right.
But we have to have that faith in the analogy of the resurrection, right? So some sort of resurrection is going to come from this moment.
Right.
From this suffering that I'm undergoing, something is going to come from it. And it's going to make sense of this suffering to the point where I will be able to say, well, I am glad I suffered that. Right? Whether it was a day ago, a week ago, or 10 years ago, right? And I think that the moment par excellence of that will be, hopefully, please God, when we are saved, right? That will be like the ultimate resurrection moment, when we are actually resurrected in our mortal bodies, and we look back at the sufferings of our life, and we'll be able to say, wow, I'm glad I underwent all that suffering.
Right.
Because this moment now makes sense.
Right. Now, Jeremy, we're going to continue this conversation after I've been talking to Jeremy Duo, who was born and raised in Gibraltar, co-founder of the Saxum Institute, and right now he is the headmaster of Chesterton Academy of Fort Worth, and we're talking about an article he wrote called Penance as Devotion. Stay tuned for the remainder of this conversation. I'm Marcus Peter, filling in for Al Cresta and Cresta in the afternoon. And good afternoon, and welcome back to Cresta in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter, filling in for Al Cresta. I'm talking to Jeremy Duo, who is the author of this new article published in Catholic Schools Magazine, the Catechetical Review, and it's entitled Penance as Devotion. Now, Jeremy, when we left off earlier, you made a very interesting point, and it's a very crucial point, something that nobody likes thinking about in the heat of it, but a lot of people realize in hindsight, which is very simply that in the worst of struggle, in the worst part of struggle, we don't often see the merit of it. But after we've come out of it, especially after years have put distance between us and the suffering, we can sometimes look back and go, wow, I'm actually grateful that happened.
Yes.
Yeah, so just shed more light on that.
Yes, there's a concept that theologians talk about in eschatology. It's called which we know by the term trophies, right? So just like winning a trophy at a competition.
Mm-hmm.
And what they talk about is the interesting fact that at least we know from our Lord retains his five wounds after the resurrection, right? Which has clued in some speculation among theologians about whether or not other saints will also retain their wounds as trophies of love for Christ, right?
Right.
So especially martyrs and people like that. And, you know, people often talk about the fact that in heaven there is no suffering, in heaven nothing's wrong, and there are no problems, right? Which is true, of course. And yet there are these reminders of earthly suffering, at least in our Lord and probably in others, remain, right? And they remain there as signs, of, as continued signs to ourselves. Now, they're not even signs that you could say they're not utilitarian signs, because at that point we will be saved. They don't serve kind of admonition to rectify our lives or anything like that, right? But yet they're just simply trophies of love, whereby those moments of intense sufferings, which in those cases caused a lot of physical pain, right, were moments of incredible love for God. And in the case of Christ, not just love for God, because absolutely Christ underwent what he did for love of the Father, but also for us, right? He retains those wounds as the trophies of love for us.
Right.
And so our earthly suffering remains as a context, in, if you will, for our heavenly glory.
And that's truly profound to think about. And even on an earthly perspective, right, you think about James chapter 1, verse 2, count ye for joy when you're faced with trial. I remember reading that verse the first time. I wasn't Catholic yet. I was still with the Pentecostals at that point. And I remember reading that verse for the first time going, James, you're off your rocker. But then he goes, count ye for joy when you're faced with trial, knowing that the end result is the ability to endure. And that's actually factually true, that as you point out in your article, bearing suffering well produces fortitude. It produces the virtue of long-suffering, so much so that it's not that the suffering doesn't hurt us, but that it doesn't break us. And therefore, we truly do unite ourselves to Jesus in his passion in a very unique way. So, you know, comment on that.
Well, it's quite simple, really. I mean, if you just look at it on a natural perspective, the path of least resistance often leads to misery, right? Mm-hmm. So you take that in terms of the body, right? If you just stay in bed all day, sit on the couch all day, eat what you want to eat all day, any day, right? Continuously.
Right.
You'll grow extremely obese, extremely unhealthy, right? And very quickly, you'll be very unhappy, because there will be certain greater joys which will be out of reach for you, right? You have chosen the smaller joys of physical gratification, right? Whether it be the lack of movement or the sensory joys of food, right? But you have given up higher joys, which can only be accessed through the sacrifice of smaller joys. Right, so, well, I'm not going to eat this pizza, or I'm not going to have the second pizza, right, or something. Well, I'm not going to stay in bed. I'm actually going to get up and go out. I'm going to walk. I'm going to run, whatever it is. I'm going to work out. Right? We choose those little sufferings, but through those little sufferings, we access this kind of almost incommensurate level of joy, of even physical pleasures, right? Because we can run and move about and experience a foretaste of what it is like to run and not grow weary, right? Like Isaiah talks about. But in the same vein, we can do the same in the spiritual life. We can forego smaller things, so even pleasures, right, for the sake of something higher, right? So we talk about fasting for spiritual reasons. So we can kind of exercise those muscles of self-control and say, you know what, I'm not going to have this food, or I'm going to have less of it, perhaps, right? Because I want to open up my spiritual senses for things that are higher. And right? I'm going to sacrifice the lower for something greater. And it's not that food is bad.
Right.
It's just that there are joys that are beyond it.
Right.
We want to open ourselves to that, especially and first and foremost to God.
Right. Especially as you mentioned in the first segment, in the season of Easter, it's so easy for us. And truly, this is not wrong. In fact, the church greatly encourages that we get into the true spirit of celebration during this time of Easter. But to also understand that the disciplines, especially the spiritual disciplines that we developed during the season of Lent, now is not the time to let them die. It's the time to maintain them so that that celebration becomes all the sweeter. So, you know, talk about that a little bit.
Well, absolutely. So we could take, for example, we take the paradigm of Lent and Easter, right? Just like before we took cross and resurrection. If we take that as a hermeneutic, as a paradigm, as a lens through which we can see things, we can see then that this life, as compared to heaven, is Lent. Our whole life is Lent, and heaven is Easter.
Right.
Right? And that's the definitive one. And so we still want to... So yes, we want to have punctuated times of enjoyment, because those are foretastes of what is to come, just like God gives us these graces and little... Yeah, foretastes is the best word, really, of what's to come, right? Jesus has often, in his earthly ministry, he would show little glimpses of his power. And like, so I'm thinking of like the Transfiguration, for example, where he shows you some, like a little glimpse of what's to come, so that when the suffering which is about to come comes, you remember that glimpse and say, oh, no, this is not the end. I have caught a glimpse. He showed me on Mount Tabor his glory.
Right.
This is not him. He is not an abject failure, right? So that was the idea of the Transfiguration, for example. And so in the same way, the church allows or encourages these times of celebration as foretaste of the joy that is to come. And yet, we must remember that it is only a foretaste.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And we cannot cling to it as if it were definitive. Right, one day we will, which is the good news. We will cling to it definitively one day. We're just not there yet, and so we have to have these two sides of the coin, right? We have to have the humanity of Christ and the divinity of Christ.
Mm-hmm.
That's the best way to think about it, I think, right? So, is Christ God or is he man? Well, the church, you know, triumphantly has always said both, right? And so, should we be doing penance or should we be celebrating? Well, both, right?
Right, right.
Bringing those two together in perfect harmony.
Right. And that's the great struggle of the Christian faith. On the one hand, yes, we are an Easter people. Hallelujah is our song. On the other hand, Jesus tells us in no uncertain terms in Luke, I think it's 19:28, if anyone wishes to follow me, he should take up his cross daily and follow me. And therein lies the great crux of the gospel message, which is that this daily carrying of the cross really does change something in us. And so one of the great recourses in our time of suffering here is this transformation that it does to the person. Left unchecked, human nature and human concupiscence tends towards complete hedonism. It is really the compulsion toward virtue that helps us temper those passions and rightly order them for human flourishing. And so it, to that end, suffering really begets the betterment of human life. Tough to think about it when you're going through it, though.
Right. Yeah, I'm thinking, you made me think about when Christ says that he who is not with me is against me. Right, he who does not gather scatters.
Mm-hmm.
So he who is not moving forward is moving backwards. Right, he who is not struggling to move forward is slipping. Like there is no stasis in the Christian life. Right.
Right.
And it's. I'm thinking of, you know, even physical things, like when we think of physics, right? I don't know if people are familiar with the term entropy, right? The state of disorder in things. Well. The state of order doesn't happen by itself. It requires an intelligent agent to actually move it in a direction that it does not naturally want to go, right? But disorder seems to happen easily and naturally. Like we leave our backyards untended and in 2 weeks they're really ugly.
That's right.
The same thing with our bedrooms and the same thing with our children and the same thing with our entire lives, right? If we don't actively work to order it, it disorders by itself.
That's right.
Right. And that's really easy to let happen, which is why we have to always be moving forward, because things don't order themselves in the same way that they do disorder themselves.
You know, it's funny that you say that, Jeremy. I taught high school for 5 years, and whenever I talk about the notion of intelligent design, I tell my students, right, if your parents came home, because they're teenagers, and so none of them have neat rooms by their own accord, except for the select few who are neat by nature. I said, if your parents came home today and saw that your bedroom was completely neat and tidy as a pin, would they assume that a tornado came and blew your entire room and put everything neatly in the order that it was supposed to be in? And they automatically answer no, because the human nature understands that when we see an order established, we necessarily understand that a virtuous mind was behind it. So
that's it.
For something as simple as a room, but even something as great as the universe itself. So when you take virtue out of the picture, you know, we tend towards entropy, we tend towards our own destruction.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. We turn to our own disorder. Yeah, we turn to our own self-hatred, right? The medievals talked about the homo curvatus, right? Mm. The curved man.
Yep.
Who when just gratifies himself, kind of becomes hunched over and is focused only on himself, which could have a physical manifestation even, right? Whereas the upright man is always standing straight, shoulders back, right? It reminds you of Jordan Peterson. facing God, facing upwards, right? Mm-hmm. To something beyond himself. And he's trying to reach, perhaps, right? Stretching his arms up like a child, right?
Yeah.
And that's what penance does. Penance is a call for that. It's like a child when the child cries and thrusts his arms up in the air for mom or dad to lift him up. That's what we're doing with penance. We're saying, hey, I know that I'm undergoing this, but I'm doing it because I want you to pick me up. I want you to embrace me, right? That's what I really want.
Right.
To be held, perhaps.
Right. Well, Jeremy, this has been a truly engaging conversation. And how can our listeners reach you if they're interested in finding out more about your writing and stuff?
They could get in touch with the school. So if they just info@chestertonacademyfw.org, they can get in touch that way and email me. And I'm happy to have conversations with people about these things. We could, if they engage on YouTube, Practicing Catholics is our podcast, or they can access it through any of the regular podcast channels.
Well, thank you, Jeremy. Thank you so much for your time. I've been talking to Jeremy Duo, who is the author of Penance as Devotion in Catechetical Review. Born and raised in Gibraltar, headmaster of Chesterton Academy of Fort Worth, I'm Marcus Peter, filling in for Al Cresta on Cresta in the Afternoon.